Pushkin.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10x points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
At roughly 4 in the morning of November the 11th, 2022, Sam Bankman-Fried signed the papers that would put his cryptocurrency exchange FTX into bankruptcy. Within hours, he was trying to walk it all back, calling the Chapter 11 filing my single biggest fuck-up. But it was too late. Control of FTX had been handed over to John Wray, a lawyer who specializes in sprawling and messy bankruptcy proceedings. Here's what Wray testified to Congress less than a month after taking control of FTX.
The FTX group's collapse appears to stem from absolute concentration of control in the hands of a small group of grossly inexperienced and unsophisticated individuals who failed to implement virtually any of the systems or controls that are necessary for a company entrusted with other people's money or assets.
Wray's the guy who oversaw the liquidation of big companies such as Enron and Nortel. The shade he throws on Sam Bankman-Fried is like a cloud of ash from Mount Vesuvius. Bankruptcies can be placed in the same legal category as divorces. They let the world know that something has gone really wrong. And the proceedings rarely leave anyone happy, except maybe for the lawyers who get paid no matter what. Also, it can be hard to figure out what actually went wrong. Everyone has a different version of events. When it comes to the bankruptcy of FTX, and bankruptcy in general, there's a lot I need to learn. So welcome to On Background from Against the Rules. I'm Michael Lewis. I've had a front row seat to the meltdown of FTX, and my next book will be all about that. In this series, I get to take you along as I interview scholars and other journalists for background context I need. Today, we're going deep into the bankruptcy system in the United States. How did it come about? How does it work now? Who's harmed, really, when a company declares bankruptcy, and who benefits? And why are people now calling for changes to the system? To answer these questions, I turn to David Skeel. He's a corporate law professor at the University of Pennsylvania and an expert on bankruptcy law in the United States. The first thing I wanted to know was why and when did he get so interested in bankruptcy?
I went to law school thinking about literature, never dreaming I would have an interest in business law at all, but I've fallen in love with it. And there were two reasons that I fell in love with it. One was I had never realized just how important bankruptcy is to American history. You know, if you look back over the 19th century and ask the question, what were the most important issues in American life in the 19th century, not just for a few years, but for the whole century? Obviously, you would say slavery was number one, but bankruptcy might have been number two.
Defend that.
There was a pitched battle over whether to have a federal bankruptcy law for a century. And pretty much every major figure in American politics came out on one side or the other side of the pro or anti-bankruptcy divide. So starting in the beginning, Alexander Hamilton was the leading pro-bankruptcy person. His view was if America was to be a commercial nation, we needed a bankruptcy system to make sure that creditors got treated fairly if debtors defaulted. Thomas Jefferson was vehemently anti-bankruptcy. His view was bankruptcy would just be a way for Northeastern creditors to take advantage of a bad farm year or a blip that caused somebody to go into debt and kick them off their farm or off their homestead. And so all through the 19th century, there was this fierce battle about whether to have a federal bankruptcy law or not. And it wasn't until the end of the century that we got a permanent law.
Back up a second for me. In Jefferson's mind, what would happen in place of bankruptcy? Like, if I was effectively bankrupt, if I was, you know, had no money and lots of debts, what did he think should happen then?
Well, there were state procedures, but they were quite limited. So a state procedure would not have effect across state lines. But I think the thinking would have been that if a debtor defaults, it'll be a messier process. There is room to take care of people locally, even if that's at the expense of Northeastern creditors. One of the big complaints about the absence of a federal bankruptcy law throughout the 19th century is there was a kind of home court advantage that the debtor and people close to the debtor had. And so it'd be a little bit more likely that your brother got repaid than a department store in the Northeast.
And the Hamilton argument is with a bankruptcy law in place, credit might flow actually more freely.
Oh, no question.
Because distant creditors would know that they were protected by the law.
That's exactly right. And there were two kinds of concerns that creditors had. One is that they wouldn't be protected and that local creditors would be protected more. And there were people in the legislative debates in the 19th century who defended that. They said, as a moral matter, you should repay your brother or your neighbor before you repay some out-of-town creditor. So there was a concern about even-handedness. There also was a concern that debtors would just abscond. You know, that if you're a debtor here in Pennsylvania, you run into financial trouble, that you'll go west. And in fact, if you look at the court records in the 19th century, you will sometimes see in a northeastern state like Pennsylvania or Delaware, on a file, you'll see the letters GTT, which stands for Gone to Texas. And one of the virtues of a federal bankruptcy law is it can reach people nationwide. So it's not, right. People cannot escape by moving to another state. So creditors wanted there to be a fair distribution of the debtor's assets. They wanted to limit debtors' abilities to abscond when they defaulted, and they thought a bankruptcy system was the way to do it.
So you become enamored of bankruptcy law because you see bankruptcy law sits right in the middle of American history.
That was the first reason. And then the other reason I became enamored of it is it's about meeting individuals and institutions in a period of distress. And if the system works well, they can end up in a better place. And I found that cool 40 years ago, 35 years ago. I still find it cool today. You know, it's about people whose lives and institutions that are in a shambles and trying to put them in a better place. And I'm a big defender of the American bankruptcy system, maybe too much of a defender, but I really think it's a great system.
So there's a controversy argument through the 30s that leads to changes in the bankruptcy laws that kind of echo something that I'm dealing with now. And I want you to talk about that a little bit. Like, what are the tensions that build up in the system that lead to it having to change?
What really drove the populist side of the 1930s was the large-scale corporate side of things, the big corporations. And so that was evolving on a separate track. So I've been talking about the federal bankruptcy law didn't or wasn't used by large corporations. With large corporations, the way things evolved was the first large corporations were railroads. Railroads were privately run in this country, as you know, unlike in many countries. There was a gold rush to control important railroad lines, a lot of mergers and cobbling things together, sort of like the telecom boom of the early 2000s and before then. And whenever we had an economic crisis, a lot of the railroads would fail. And when they failed, it created a very odd dilemma, which is everybody thought that we needed the railroads. They needed to be reorganized. They needed to be kept in place on the one hand. But it wasn't clear that there was a legal basis for doing that. It wasn't clear Congress could step in and put a railroad reorganization statute in place. And the reason for this was there was a bankruptcy clause in the Constitution, but in the 19th century, a lot of people didn't think that applied to corporations. They thought corporations are governed by the states. They're not governed by Congress. Bankruptcy clause must not have corporations in mind. That argument eventually lost, but it was a very serious argument for a long time. What ended up happening was Wall Street lawyers and Wall Street bankers cobbled up this incredibly ingenious use of ordinary foreclosure law and turned it into a way to restructure large corporations. And what they did was when a railroad defaulted, some of the bondholders would ask the court to foreclose on their bonds, which had mortgages on railroad property. They were secured by mortgages. So the bondholders would ask the court to start a foreclosure proceeding, but they would say, but court, don't have the sale now. We'll tell you when we're ready for the sale. And then the Wall Street bankers would form committees of the bonds or the stocks that they had underwritten. They would negotiate with one another and with the debtor. They would work out the terms of the reorganization. They would then form one big committee called the Reorganization Committee. Then they'd go back to the court and they'd say, court, we're ready for our foreclosure sale now. And there would be exactly one bidder at the foreclosure sale, which would be the reorganization committee. And it would bid all of the old stock, all of the old bonds, plus a little bit of cash to pay off the people who couldn't be persuaded to go along. So it was this incredibly ingenious distortion of ordinary foreclosure law that was turned into a reorganization framework. So it was this kind of informal reorganization strategy, which was called railroad receivership or equity receivership. And it was used for decades with no statute at all until the 1930s. And then it finally got codified in the 1930s, in the early 1930s. And about the time it was getting codified, the New Deal reformers said, wait a second, this is outrageous. These Wall Street banks and lawyers are ripping everybody off. And that's what led to the big overhaul in 1938.
And what happens in that?
They essentially destroy the Wall Street practice. So what the 1938 law did, it was called the Chandler Act of 1938, is it said, if you are a bank or if you are a law firm that represented the debtor before they file for bankruptcy, you can't have anything to do with them in bankruptcy, which makes the old railroad receivership process impossible because it was based on the original bankers who'd underwritten the stock or bonds and the Wall Street lawyers being the same people who would work things out after default. But they were kicked out of the process. And then finally, in 1978, Congress overhauled the bankruptcy laws again, and we essentially went back to the old practice where the managers of the company are not kicked out when it files for bankruptcy. They continue running the company. The fact that you were a banker or a lawyer for the company before bankruptcy does not preclude you from representing it. Interestingly, there's a little FTX angle there. There was a bit of a firestorm about something.
Let's wait on that. We'll be right back.
As listeners of this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert teams of nerds have the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. but you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment. It's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
I'm back with bankruptcy expert David Skeel. So I want to turn you to my purposes now, because I want to talk about it. Now I want to talk about FTX. And I want to walk you through just like some specific questions I have.
Okay.
As I've watched, because I've watched it unfold. I was there the day that Sam Bankman-Fried signed the bankruptcy papers.
Oh my gosh.
And he said this publicly, that it's the worst thing he ever did and he shouldn't have done it. And he only did it because the internal counsel was yelling at him. Everybody was yelling at him. So he signs these things at 4 a.m. and 5 minutes later changes his mind and says he wants it back. And they say it's too late. You've already signed them. So first question is, so you basically understand, you have a sense of what FTX was as a business. It was a cryptocurrency exchange. There were 100 and something different entities. It had, you know, exchange in Japan, an exchange in Turkey. It had an exchange in the United States. But the bulk of the business was in the Bahamas. And he's in the Bahamas. And most of the important employees are in the Bahamas. What would happen if he doesn't sign? He's being asked to declare bankruptcy in the United States, even though the vast majority of what he's doing is outside of the United States and the vast majority of what he's doing is even illegal for Americans to participate in. If he doesn't sign, what would have happened?
Probably what happens is FTX gets thrown into bankruptcy in the U.S.
Not in the Bahamas.
Well, there's going to be a proceeding in the Bahamas as well. I believe the Bahamas liquidators initiated that themselves.
That's true.
So that probably.
So, but how would it have gotten thrown into bankruptcy in the United States?
As a technical matter, it is very easy to put a company into bankruptcy. All it takes is you have to have three creditors that sign the petition, and they have to have roughly $19,000 in general obligations, general unsecured claims. So you could take three customers.
The American creditors were such a trivial part of the business, they could easily have just paid them off. Presumably, these would have to have been American creditors in the United States.
Not necessarily. What they need is an American presence, and FTX did have an American presence, so they would not need to be American creditors. He couldn't pay off enough people to stop it, I don't think. I mean, it's a little trickier with something like FTX, because they don't have a lot of the ordinary creditors, you know, the big bank lenders who are sophisticated, working together and would plot something like this out. I mean, it might have been that there were not three creditors who were ready to file a petition right away, but there would have been a petition almost certainly filed in the U.S. because typically, if you have a choice, you probably want to have a U.S. proceeding because people like the U.S. bankruptcy system.
He didn't have the power to control where he went bankrupt.
He could have conditioned his willingness to sign on it being filed in a particular place. So he would have had power in that sense.
Within the United States. But he couldn't have said, I'm bankrupt in the Bahamas and the Bahamas is going to deal with my case and the assets are here and everybody else, you can screw yourself.
He can say that, but the world doesn't have to listen to him. I think there was a concern that I've heard about that he was moving assets away, and the longer it took to get into bankruptcy, the more risk there was that assets would be gone by the time they got into bankruptcy.
Or so let me ask you this then. What are the checks on the insiders who are now controlling the bankruptcy process from just bleeding the firm for fees rather than getting the assets back to the owners?
There are a handful of checks of varying degrees of effectiveness. So there is a watchdog. There's an entity called the U.S. trustee.
Ah, okay. And who is that person? Like, where did that role come from and what powers do they have?
It's an arm of the Justice Department, and they were put in place as a watchdog. They were created in 1978 when the current bankruptcy laws went into place, kind of as a replacement for the Securities and Exchange Commission. Before 1978, the Securities and Exchange Commission played a major role in large bankruptcies. They were kind of kicked out in 1978, and the U.S. trustee is to some extent their replacement. So they're a government entity. They're a watchdog. One of the things they do look at is fees and conflicts of interest and things of that sort. One of the problems, and one of the reasons why the U.S. trustee is needed, is the most obvious check on attorneys or financial advisors churning, you know, wasting money would be other attorneys and financial advisors, because they can see it, they understand it. But because all of these folks are repeat players and they're all part of the same inside group of attorneys and financial advisors, they don't have an incentive to be a check on each other. So it does require somebody else. And so the U.S. trustee is one check.
Let me stop you one sec there. Does the Department of Justice have any recourse?
They really don't. They really don't.
They don't. All right. So there isn't a real check. There's a person who can kind of do journalism, and the judge can read the journalism and decide whether he's going to believe it or not.
Those are your words, not mine. But there are limits to the check, and I will kind of consistent with what you're saying, say that the U.S. trustee is often seen as a gadfly, you know, kind of a pest that that we insiders need to, you know, have to put up with. Not always. It really depends on who the U.S. trustee is, but it's not a complete check. And the other check that's emerged in recent years is in a lot of cases, there are fee examiners. So there is somebody who's brought in to look at the fees and to raise questions about the fees and to challenge the fees where they're problematic. I don't know if there's a fee examiner in FTX. I would think there probably will be one if there's not. But that's another check. But you know, your follow-up question will be, at the end of the day, how much of a check is this? And you know, my answer would be it's not a huge check. You know, there is a potential issue there. I think by and large the professionals do a good job, and they don't tend to just drag out a case to drag it out, but there is opportunity to run up fees. There's no denying that.
What kind of person becomes a bankruptcy judge?
It's usually a bankruptcy lawyer that becomes a bankruptcy judge.
So it's someone who's pretty sympathetic to the fees that bankruptcy lawyers get paid.
It's somebody who tends to be pretty sympathetic to the system.
If I'm going to have you moneyball bankruptcy judging, all right, and figure out who the good ones are, who the bad ones are, what trait would you look for?
One thing I would look for is thick skin. Some bankruptcy judges take things a little bit too personally, in my view. So thick skin is a nice quality. Another good quality is not being in a rush to pass judgment on whatever the issue is. A lot of bankruptcy judges put a premium on encouraging the parties to settle. I think sometimes there can be a little too much of that. The judge is at an informational disadvantage. There's a huge amount of information floating around, but the judge doesn't know as much as the insiders do about what's going on in a case. And so they really have to have kind of a sixth sense or a nose for problems, because most of a bankruptcy judge's power is veto power or power to say no. The bankruptcy judge doesn't make the deal. The bankruptcy judge doesn't decide what the terms of the restructuring are. The bankruptcy judge either approves it or doesn't approve it. So they have to really know when to call BS, essentially. And that's hard, because it's a system that's run by insiders. They're incredibly sophisticated. They're incredibly smart. And they are very good at putting the judge in a position where the judge feels like they don't have any choice. Companies come to bankruptcy. They're out of cash. Their lender says, you've got to sell the assets to this buyer right now, or the company is going to go up in smokes. And the judge has to make a decision. Do I call their bluff, or do I just say okay? And it's really hard, because if you call their bluff and it turns out it's not just a bluff, there can be a lot of value destroyed and a lot of lives made worse. And so it's very tough.
After a quick break, David Skeel and I get into what may turn out to be one of the hairiest hairballs in the FTX bankruptcy proceedings. All those generous donations that Sam Bankman-Fried made to charity.
As listeners of this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert teams of nerds have the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet, but you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment. It's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
I'm back with David Skeel on Background. There's one other big subject I'm really curious about now. I'm sure it's going to change and I'm going to bother you again later, but clawbacks. So FTX is not just in bankruptcy, but it's in bankruptcy and the people who ran it are being charged with fraud. And anybody who received money from this place, employees, people who did sponsorship deals with them, people who received philanthropic dollars from them, people who got investment returns from them, are now facing the possibility they're going to have to give the money back into the bankruptcy. And some of these amounts are quite astonishing. Like Sam Bankman-Fried wrote a check for $2 billion to buy out his rival and competitor 18 months ago. And the question is, what right does the bankruptcy have to claw money back that went out? Like, is there a lot of precedent for this? If Sam Bankman-Fried gave me $1 million a year ago, or 6 months ago to cure cancer. And I'm just a cancer researcher. And now they come knock on my door and they say they want the $1 million back. What's the likelihood I have to give it back?
It's really high. It's the likelihood. So,
is it really? I didn't know that.
It is. The clause.
What if I spent it on cancer research?
Then you've got a problem. Assuming that we can link it to FTX, then the clawback stuff goes into motion. If somehow he gave money that was truly his money, that wasn't FTX money, then he's not in bankruptcy at this point, at least. And so the clawbacks wouldn't apply. But to the extent it's commingled and it's FTX money, there is a very high risk that this has to come back. And the way it comes back is as what's called a fraudulent conveyance. And there are two ways that a transfer can be a fraudulent conveyance. One is if Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX was trying to stiff creditors, you know, wanted to give it to the cancer researcher because he just really didn't like his creditors, thought they were a bunch of jerks. That would be actual fraud. The other form of fraudulent conveyance is what's called constructive fraud or constructive fraudulent conveyance. And you have to show two things. One is that the debtor, FTX, was insolvent at the time or nearly insolvent at the time. And the second is that the transfer was made for less than reasonably equivalent value. So if you're transferring money to a cancer researcher, you're not getting anything for it. So there's no value being received.
But if I came in as a plumber and fixed your plumbing, that would be different. If you were paying me for some service that I provided.
That's right. You know, assuming that I paid you, you know, the debtor paid the reasonable value for the service, not five times what the service is worth. Yes, that would be fine. You can do new transactions. What you can't do is sell assets for less than they're worth within the 2 years before bankruptcy or give assets away. And charitable contributions look like giving assets away. And what a lot of folks seem to have done, or at least some folks seem to have done with Sam Bankman-Fried contributions, is treated them like hot potatoes. You know, when there were problems, they thought, oh my, they might come after me. And some people, like politicians, I think, turned around and gave the money to some other charity.
But that doesn't solve their problem.
It doesn't solve the problem at all. And it makes it worse in a way because you don't have the money and you still have to give it back.
Right. Sam Bankman-Fried was handing out money left and right to people. He's the most open-handed person in our hemisphere. And everybody on the receiving end was so grateful. And they were so happy they were getting all this money. And now they've got the biggest headache of their lives.
Oh, it's really true. And one of the big legal ethical dilemmas of the case, I think, is going to be, do you go after everybody? You know, do you go after little people, the people that, you know, somebody that got $25,000, that's a lot of money for them, but not much money for the customers and other creditors of FTX. There are going to be some real difficult decisions, I think, about who to go after and who not to go after. But the norm is that you go after everybody.
If just hypothetically, if he had paid me to write his biography, and like say he paid me a fortune to write his biography, and I was still writing the biography, would they come after me? Or would they wait to see if the biography was worth it?
I mean, they might go after you even if the biography is going to make millions of dollars.
I am so glad this isn't an authorized biography. I mean, it's just, what a hairball. I mean, he's affected precisely all the things he cares about most because that's where the money went.
I think that's right. I mean, everybody that he was kind of trying to help and do good things, as you said, they now have a very big problem.
You said something earlier that was interesting to me, that you have to show not only that you didn't get value for it or equivalent value, but you have to show that when the money changed hands, the enterprise was insolvent. So you need to identify the moment of insolvency.
That's the big sticking point with fraudulent conveyance actions. There are two or three different things that you can show, each of which is related to insolvency. And it can be very, very difficult to show. So that will be a big issue.
That's going to be where the arguments happen.
So I have one more twist for you on the fraudulent conveyance stuff, which I don't think is going to change that answer. But the one more interesting quirk of fraudulent conveyance law is if you are running a Ponzi scheme, you know, like the Madoff Ponzi scheme, there is a presumption that any money you transferred was actual fraud. Now, pretty unfathomable that a court would conclude FTX was a Ponzi scheme. You know, it's not a true Ponzi scheme, but if somehow they did, all of these transfers might be actual fraud rather than constructive fraud, so that you wouldn't even have to show the insolvency. Won't happen, I don't think, but...
I don't think so either, because it was actually a legitimate, profitable business on its own. All right. This was really interesting. Dave, thank you so much.
You are quite welcome.
Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Let's end today by answering a question from one of our listeners, or maybe more than one. Caleb. Caleb asks, "Hi, Michael. Can you let us know what podcast you're listening to right now and the best books you read in 2022? Thank you." Caleb, thanks for being so polite. You know, I'm right now in a funny creative place. I've just handed in a screenplay for a TV show, a pilot for a TV show, and I've just at the same time started writing a book. And I'm writing. And when I really start writing, I tend not to read or listen to anything. And it's just like, I'm bored with everything but what I'm working on. Bored's the wrong word. I'm annoyed by it. I don't want to be distracted by it. So I'm not really listening to any podcasts right now. I'm going to change your question a little bit. What's the last podcast that just absolutely riveted me? And I was a little late to it, but there was a podcast called The Just Enough Family by Ariel Levy, or Levy. I don't know how you pronounce her last name. But it's a 1980s story about Saul Steinberg, the tycoon, the takeover person, and essentially the aftershocks of both his rise and his fall. It's told through members of his family. And it's the most extraordinary act of reportage, because what Ariel Levy does, she essentially gets the characters in this family to talk to you about their experiences and about each other. You can barely imagine them talking about themselves and each other to their therapists. I mean, you're just like in the middle of the mess. And, you know, the whole thing about all happy families are the same and every unhappy family is different in its own way. This unhappy family has just an extraordinary way of being unhappy. And I just thought, you know, bravo. A brava. All right. On Background is hosted by me, Michael Lewis, and produced by Catherine Girardot and Lydia Jean Cott. Our editor is Julia Barton. Our engineer is Sarah Brugger. Thanks to our SVP of production, Greta Cohn. Our show is recorded by Topher Ruth at Berkeley Advanced Media Studios. Our music was composed by Matthias Bossi and John Evans of Stellwagen Symphonette. My old friend Nick Bertel composed our theme song. On Background is a production of Pushkin Industries. Don't forget that we have a website, atrpodcast.com, in case you want to send me a question or a complaint or anything at all. I'll read the questions, I won't read the complaints. That's atrpodcast.com. To find more Pushkin podcasts, listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you'd like to listen ad-free and learn about other exclusive offerings, don't forget to sign up for a Pushkin Plus subscription at pushkin.fm/plus or on our Apple show page.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10x points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.